Amazon Web Services.
Welcome to the Cloudonaut podcast. My name is Andreas.
And my name is Michael.
We are brothers and freelancers focusing 100% on Amazon Web Services. We do technical coaching, for example, for teams that start their journey with AWS. And we do infrastructure bootstrapping, typically based on our infrastructure as code templates for our clients worldwide. And every other week, we discuss a topic related to AWS in this podcast. One of us prepares the topic, which is not known to the other one. And so, Michael, what is the subject for today?
Yeah, today we are going to talk about the available messaging options on AWS. So things like SQS, but also Kinesis. We are looking into the MQ service and also into more niche services like the IoT service. So basically, it's a overview of all the options, and I will compare them and I will highlight the like typical scenarios where you will use one and why it makes sense to use it. So what are the pros and the cons of each service? So that's the overall goal of today.
Oh, that sounds interesting. So that's especially for architects and developers who plan to design a new system on AWS. So that they have an overview of the available messaging options. Cool. So before we start, I want to say, so this is the episode 22 of the Cloudonaut podcast, and we're recording this on June 19th, 2020. And there is a blog post related to this podcast episode, which appeared first on the Cloudcraft blog. So Cloudcraft is a cool web application that you can use to draw architecture diagrams for AWS, and I would say they look special, they look very cool, and so this is a cool way to visualize what you are building on AWS. And another thing before we start, so I'm really happy to announce that we have released chapter 2 for the Rapid Docker on AWS video course. So we have released Rapid Docker on AWS, the ebook, last year. The goal is to give you a fast way to deploy your web application Dockerized on AWS. So you learn everything you need to know about how to Dockerize an application. So we have examples for PHP, Java, Node, Python, and so on. And you learn how to Dockerize your existing application and then how to deploy that to AWS in a professional way, which means by using infrastructure as code and setting up a production ready and secure environment. And we have a video course, or we're doing a video course for that as well. We are in the progress of creating that. So chapter 1 is already available as the video course. And since yesterday, Michael, Chapter 2 is available as well. So maybe can you talk us through what's the learning goals of Chapter 2, which is now available?
Yeah, Andrea. So in Chapter 2, we take the existing application of the learner and we turn it into a Dockerized application. So for example, if this is a PHP application, we create two Docker images, one for Nginx, the other one for the PHP container. And then we spin everything up locally using Docker Compose. So we create a Docker Compose file, make sure that everything is configured correctly. And then last but not least, we deploy the whole thing to AWS. So that's kind of the goal of Chapter 2, Dockerizing and deploying your own application to AWS.
Wow, that sounds very cool. So that's basically everything you need to know to get started with Docker. Cool. So you will find a link to Rapid Docker on AWS, the ebook and the video course in the show notes, and we really highly recommend that if you have an application that is not yet Dockerized and not yet running on AWS, that's very a good way to get started quickly. Okay, so that's enough about all the announcements. So Michael, then let's jump into the topic, messaging on AWS. What's the first service that we will have a look at?
Yeah, so I think before we are really looking into the options, I will just explain why this is a interesting topic at all. And the motivation for it, doing this is that we can process messages asynchronously, which means on the one side, we have the producer of a message, and the producer sends the message to the messaging system. And on the other side of the messaging system, we have the consumer, and the consumer can read the messages in at different speed and a different time than they were produced.
Okay, so that is, I assume that this is especially important when you have a microservice architecture where you have multiple services that need to interact with each other, and you want to decouple them to be able to deploy them independently and also to have a little bit of a buffer in between to handle traffic spikes and stuff.
Yeah, so I agree. So basically, it's a good idea. So if you can, you should always make the communication between two systems asynchronously, if possible, because then you can. So for example, you can. So if there are spikes in the system, like one system creates lots of messages, but the other one is not as fast in processing them, then the messaging system is kind of a buffer, as you mentioned. But it also makes things like deployments much easier, because you can, for a certain amount of time, completely stop the consumer side, roll out the update, and then start processing the messages again. Also, in case of failure, you have some kind of buffer that you can use to fix the problem without anyone noticing things. So that's always a good idea. So if you can, then I would always prefer an asynchronously system over a synchronous one.
Yeah, I think there's something else that comes to my mind is it also makes scaling a lot easier. So we all have the goal to scale our infrastructure based on the capacity we really need on AWS to reduce costs, because yeah, that's really the big benefit of the cloud, right? But scaling is not that easy if you have a request response model. So if you have a load balancer and you need to respond immediately to each incoming request, it gets much easier if you have a small kind of queue or messaging system in between. Then scaling the infrastructure for the workers is much easier.
Yeah, I agree. So let's start with the options, Andreas. So the first service that I will have a look at is SQS, the Simple Queue service. And that's a service that probably lots of our listeners already know. And SQS comes in two flavors. So there are so-called standard queues. So this is what we had from the beginning. And then there are FIFO queues. And we will talk about the FIFO queues in a minute. So let's focus on the standard queues for now. So standard queues are, that's basically the most convenient option you can dream of. So that was one of the first serverless offerings that AWS had. And at this time, it wasn't called serverless, because an SQS queue is, you just create the queue, so there's nothing to administrate. So you can send as many messages as you like to those queues, and you can read as many messages as you like, and they will be queued for up to 14 days. So that's kind of the limitations of the system. The messages are only stored for up to 14 days. So the key thing to understand here is that a message is intended to be consumed by only one process. So you send a message and only one receives the message. So that's the overall goal. But there are two kind of surprises when you work with SQS. So the first surprise for many people is that SQS does not preserve the order of messages. So if you send three messages into a queue, it is not guaranteed that the consumer side will read them in the same order. So that's something that you have to keep in mind. So if order is important for you, then the standard queues are not a good choice.
Yeah, so I think the thing that we have to mention here is SQS does its best to preserve the order, but it's not guaranteed. So you cannot really rely on that. That's really an important thing, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And the second surprise is that a message may be delivered more than once. And this is usually called at least once delivery. So what are the reasons for this? And I can think of two kind of different, or you can think of this problem in two different perspectives. So the first perspective is from the producer side. So what if the producer wants to send a message, but you get an error back from the API or from like the network stack? So there's basically no, or you cannot really know if the message was actually sent or not. So if there's an error, like a timeout, you actually don't know. So if you retry, then the message will be sent twice, because there is no way of deduplication of messages in standard queues. So that's the first reason why something could be delivered more than once, because the producer actually produced it twice. And then if you look from the other perspective, the consumer, then the consumer can also fail. So you read a message from SQS, then you do your work. And if you are done with doing your work in SQS, you have to confirm that you are done by deleting the message. And in between this time, things can go wrong, and also a timeout can be hit. And if you do not delete the message after or within the timeout period, then the message will be become available for consumption again. So this is cool for retries, but it also implies that a message could be received more than once. So the only way to deal with this problem is that the consumer side implementation has to be idempotent. So no matter if you process the message once or more than once, the result has to be the same. So usually this can be achieved by some ID that is generated by the producer that is part of the message. And with this ID, you can ensure that the work is only done once, because this is kind of your primary key in the database or things like this.
Yeah, so that's very cool, a very cool summary. So I have something to add to SQS. I think SQS is a really powerful service. I like to add this to architectures that are built very much, because I think the main advantage is it scales automatically. You can send as many messages as you want, no matter of any spikes or anything. You have the guarantee that the message will be delivered. So that is maybe something that we haven't talked about yet. So you have the guarantee that sometime a worker will pick up the message. So you have that. This is something that is guaranteed. And maybe back to SQS is not guaranteeing the order, and it's not guaranteeing that each message is only processed once. So I think it's really important to have that in mind when building a system based on SQS. I think it's not a good idea to say, okay, so it's very unlikely that that happens. So because if you ask, for example, AWS support, or maybe your solution architect from AWS, and you might ask them, so how likely is it that it happens that, I don't know, the order is not guaranteed, or that the message is delivered more than once? And they might say it's not very likely that this will happen. But I think it's important to know that things will go wrong, and your messages will be out of order, and the messages will be delivered more than once. And I think it's not a very good idea to ignore that fact. So you really have to build that into your system. You have to make sure, as you said, to process messages in an idempotent way, or you have to just think about how you can work around that limitation. It really has to be thought of. You cannot just use it otherwise. So that is important. But I think when you do that, you get a really powerful service. I think another thing, Michael, that is very useful when building with SQS is, so I built a system that schedules jobs to fetch data from various APIs to collect the data and to prepare the data for analytics later. And what I like about SQS there is when I do processing of jobs to fetch data from third-party APIs, a lot can go wrong. Yeah, so my worker picks up the job from the SQS queue and then starts fetching data from an API, from a third-party API. And a lot of stuff can go wrong. The API could not be responsible. The data could not be available, whatever. And I think a very interesting feature of SQS is that you can really get a retry mechanism built in. So you can configure that a message will be redelivered if it does not complete within a certain amount of time. And by using that mechanism, you can really easily build a system that just retries automatically, and you increase the resilience of your system a lot by doing so. So I think that is maybe another interesting feature of SQS.
Yeah, and the last thing to add here is that the pricing is also pretty nice, because you pay per message, basically. So if there's no messages transferred between producers and consumers, then there are no charges associated with such queues, which is pretty nice in serverless applications. So I will jump into the next service, and I already mentioned this. SQS comes with standard queues and FIFO queues, so let's see what they can do. So the FIFO queue, so FIFO stands for first in, first out, and this kind of implies that this kind of queue guarantees order, and that's exactly what they are designed to do. And besides the guaranteed order, they also provide a way to ensure that a message is not produced twice. So on the producer side, you can ensure by providing a ID, and if you send a message with the same ID twice, it will only be published once. So that's pretty cool. So you can now implement retries on the producer side without the problem that the message will be produced twice. So remember, this was a problem with the standard queues. So this sounds pretty cool. And if this was everything, everyone should use FIFO queues because they are actually better. But the big problem here is that FIFO queues can only handle 300 messages per second, or 3,000 messages if you send them in batches of 10. So basically you can do 300 write operations. So that's a big limitation. And this limitation was not existing for the standard queues at all. So for standard queues, you can send as much as you like, and you can read as much as you like. And that's not the case for FIFO queues. So how does it work? If you want to consume the messages in order, the other kind of problem that you have is that you can actually only consume them with a single consumer. Because if you have more than one consumer, then you can still, like, while the consumers are working, they could one could be faster than the other. And then the orders, again, no longer maintained. So the trick here is, if you still want to have multiple consumers, is that you can create so-called groups of messages. And within such a group, the order is guaranteed. And then it kind of gets problematic again. So if you want to have a total order of your queue, you can only use a single consumer. And if you can relax this a little bit, for example, you could maybe use a group for each customer or things like this, and you only need an order within a single customer, then you can use such groups. And then one consumer is kind of responsible for a single group, and then you can have parallelization, but still maintain the order at least within a group of messages.
So in that case, Michael, does the worker need to know which group of messages it needs to fetch? Or is that handled automatically?
You don't have to know about the group.
Okay, so I have never used SQS FIFO, Michael, but I have a question. Is there a difference from a price perspective compared to the standard queue?
That's a good question, Andreas. And I have to be honest, I don't know.
Okay.
So we have to double check this.
Yeah, okay.
I'm not sure, yeah.
Okay, but I think from what I... So my mind model about SQS FIFO is it is less of a distributed system as the standard queues. So that allows SQS FIFO to communicate between multiple workers, multiple nodes that basically that system consists of. But that also limits the maximum throughput here. So I think SQS standard queue is a really highly distributed system that you can send as many messages as you want to, which comes with some limitations. And FIFO is not that distributed. It's probably distributed among availability zones, but not among, I don't know, 100 of nodes. And but you can get the limitation that you cannot send more than 300 or 3,000 messages per second, which is in some cases probably fine. But in others, you probably cannot really plan with that limitation. One other thing that comes to my mind, I assume that I can create more than one SQS FIFO queue. So I could use, I don't know, 2 or 3 or 100 SQS FIFO queues if I need to work around that limitation of the 300 or 3,000 messages per second. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. So you could kind of create your own partition logic or sharding logic. But again, I mean, it gets very complicated.
Sure.
Regarding your pricing question, I just checked this out. So the FIFO queues are 25% more expensive than the standard queues, like from a message perspective. So they are slightly more expensive, but not significant.
Okay. And I think overall pricing with SQS, at least from the projects that I have done with SQS, pricing was never an issue. So it was never a problem to send, I don't know, millions or whatever messages over SQS from a price perspective. I don't know what's your experience with that, but I never had a real problem with the pricing model there.
Yeah, so that's also what I see. So the pricing usually makes a lot of sense compared with the price to process the messages. So it's not a significant part of your bill.
Yeah. Probably also compared to the other options that we will have a look now.
Yeah, so it only gets more expensive, basically. But one exception is the next service, SNS. So that's kind of the same than SQS, but then it gets more expensive. Yeah. Okay, so what is SNS? So that's the Simple Notification Service. And the key thing to understand here is that with SQS, you send a message, a message is produced, and it is received by one consumer if things are not going wrong. So if there are no retries. And SNS is completely different. So with SNS, you publish a message and then all the consumers will receive the message. So it's a kind of fan out or publish subscribe system. And also the message is not persisted. So if you are not subscribed to the topic as a consumer, you will miss the message. So you cannot subscribe afterwards and then receive the message or something like this. So there's no persistent subscription or things like this. So if you're not there for consumption, then you will miss the message. The big benefit is that it's like SQS standard queues. It's kind of a zero operational effort system. So there is nothing to do. You just create a topic and that's it. And it you can send as many messages as you like and you can subscribe. And then the system will make sure that it works. What are the limitations here? So it is kind of the same limitations than with SQS. So it's a at least once delivery system and there is no order guarantee at all. And if you have no subscribers on a topic, then it's kind of a death knell or black hole. You can just send as many messages as you like, but no one will receive them. So keep this in mind that this is a little bit more important here. So SQS is kind of a way to buffer messages if things go wrong. With SNS, if things go wrong, then they are lost, or you have to implement other mechanisms to make sure that you kind of persist the messages. So maybe one interesting fact here is that a SNS consumer can be many things. It could be a Lambda function, it can be an SQS queue, it can also be an HTTP endpoint. So they will trigger your HTTP endpoint or HTTPS endpoint. It can also send, and this is what SNS makes a little bit confusing. You can also send emails and you can also send SMS with it. So I think at the time where SNS was created and where this was added, they kind of had some overlap. The system does lots of things, including sending SMS, which doesn't make much sense for a system that can also send messages to SQS. But when we talk about messaging systems, then just think of SNS as a publish subscribe system. So any questions, Andreas, or can we go on?
No, I think it's also a very basic service, and you will kindly it's very likely that you are using SNS to, I don't know, forward CloudWatch alarms or in many cases, architectures on AWS use SNS in a way. Not in all cases, SNS is really the main messaging component, but it's a very interesting concept. And I think also interesting is that you can configure retries with SNS as well. So you can define what happens in case SNS cannot deliver a message and how often it will retry. And what happens if SNS gives up on delivering a message, you can also persist that message if you want for, I don't know, failure analytics or resending that message later or what have you. Yeah, that's maybe interesting as well. Yeah, really cool service, basic one. But I think the simple services on AWS, so SQS, SNS, and it's also S3, the simple storage service, those are all very cool building blocks for architectures, I would say, because they are so simple. They are very powerful as well.
Yeah, that's right. So let's talk about the next service, Andreas. And this is Amazon Kinesis Data Streams. So a few years before, this was just Amazon Kinesis, and now it's called Data Streams because there are other streams as well, and also other like capabilities like analytics built into the service. So Kinesis basically provides everything that's needed to do real-time data analytics. But in this episode here, we focus on the data streams. So what are data streams? So data streams are a log of messages. And if you write messages or send messages to it, you will append them at the end. So that's the only option that's available. And when you read a message, then you do not delete messages from this stream. You can only basically remember the point in the stream that you have seen last, and from this point on, you can read the next messages. So it's kind of a sequence of messages, and if you start reading them, for example, from the beginning, then you get a batch of messages, and it also returns the next position in the stream, and then you can read from this next position. And this is called like the iterator. So you iterate through all the messages, and if you like, you can at any time start from the beginning again.
Yes. So if you think about data structure, it's basically a sorted list, and you iterate over that sorted list, for example, from the beginning to the end.
Yeah, and it's sorted by time, but you have to be a little bit careful. And we will talk about order in a minute. Okay, so one limitation that could be an issue is that Kinesis does not store your messages forever. It will drop them after 7 days. So it's configurable. You can define the time from 1 to 7 days, but it's not possible to keep them for longer than 7 days. And the interesting information here is that Kinesis does keep order of messages, but only what Kinesis calls a shard. So what is a shard? A shard can handle up to 1 megabyte of second of data, or up to 1,000 messages per second. So that's the restrictions of a shard. And if you need more capacity in your stream, you have to add shards. But only within a shard you have order. So basically, when you send a message, and Kinesis calls this a record, but that's kind of the same thing. So when you send a message to Kinesis, you specify a key that Kinesis uses to assign the shard. And as long as this key is the same, the message will always land on the same shard. So for example, in Marbot, in our chatbot that works with Slack and Microsoft Teams, we can send all kinds of alerts from AWS to your chat window. We use Kinesis streams for all the processing. So if a alert arrives, or if a API hook from Slack or Microsoft Teams arrives, then we put this message to a Kinesis stream, and we use the team ID in Slack and in Microsoft Teams, we use the tenant ID to assign the shard. So with this, we have guarantee that for a single team, we have exact order of all the messages. So nothing can get out of order inside a team. And that's totally fine for us, because we don't need order across teams, because messages only operate on a single team.
Yeah, but so, and also, Michael, but on the other side, it also limits the number of messages per team to, what was it, 1,000 messages per second, right?
Yes, per second, yeah.
Yeah, but that's a lot.
Yeah, that's a lot, and we actually have throttling before on the API side, and we don't allow 1,000 API calls per second for a team. So that's not a problem for us. But yeah, if you have, or if you expect more than 1,000 messages, then the team is not a good idea for splitting up and sharding. So you have to come up with something else. So in our case, it could be the channel ID and things like this. So that's about Kinesis. So let's look at the problems of the, what kind of guarantee is provided when you read, like, of delivery guarantee. And I would say that's also a kind of at least one system, because on the producer side, there is no way to avoid resending the same message twice. So if you get an error from the Kinesis API, and if you retry, there's no way for you to know that the message was only sent once. It could be already in the stream. And so this implies that the consumer has to, again, be implemented in an idempotent way, the same way as for SQS queues and also for SNS.
Yeah, which might be easier if you have at least the order guarantee. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's the system basically adds the order guarantee compared to SQS. And the downside is that you now have to care about the shards because you are responsible for adding and removing shards. So that's kind of your problem, and this was not a task that was available if you use SQS queues. So if you really need the order, you can buy this guarantee by caring about shards. So you can you can kind of try to avoid it, but if you really need the order, then that's, I think, a good idea.
So basically, from a scaling perspective, that means I can add as many shards as I want. Is that correct?
So I'm not sure if you can add as many as you want. So there are definitely quotas, and they can be increased. I'm not sure what the exact upper limit is, but you can add lots of shards. So I think, so definitely 500 and more is possible.
Yeah, so the idea is that you can scale horizontally by adding more shards to the system. So there is no limit as you have with SQS FIFO, for example. You're doing it by adding shards. And then really what's interesting, Michael, can you talk us through the pricing model of Kinesis?
Yeah, so that's a good point, Andreas, and I forgot to talk about this. So with Kinesis, you have two dimensions where you pay for. So one is you pay for the shard hour. So for each shard that you provision, you pay a fee per hour. So this is independent of if you're using the system or not. So there's a base cost basically for the system. And then you also pay for the API calls. So it's more inconvenient than SQS pricing because you have this baseline fee, and I think a shard is around $5 if I remember this correctly. It's not a problem if the system is using or transferring data all the time, but if this is a test system, if you create one for every pull request, then this can easily add up and could be a problem. Yeah.
And another question that comes to my mind is, so I talked about how SQS or how it can handle failures with SQS, so the retry thing and everything. So how do I do that with Kinesis? So what happens if a worker, for some reason, cannot process a message? What happens then?
So there are multiple options. So I have to correct my pricing estimation. It is not $5, it's $10 per month. So sorry for that. So it's twice as much. Okay, so what happens if things go wrong on the consumer, on the reading side? So this depends on the implementation of the consumer. So if you, for example, connect a Lambda function to the Kinesis stream, the default behavior is just to retry and retry and retry and retry forever. So basically, in the moment where there's an error in your logic, the processing stops at this point in the stream, and it will retry for, in the worst case, it takes 7 days until this message is deleted that you cannot process because of some error. The better option would be that you fix the problem as soon as possible, and then things will continue to work. So this is one option, and that was the kind of only option that was available until a few months ago. And now you have additional options. So if you read from a Kinesis stream, or to be more precise, from a shard, you can specify the batch size. So you can say, okay, give me 50 records at once, or maybe only 10 or something like this. But basically, if things go wrong, there could be multiple messages in the batch.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't necessarily know which message causes the error. So it could be that there are 50 messages in the batch, and like message number 26 has the problem. So each time the system retries, you will retry the whole batch. So not only starting from the message that failed, but you will try all the 25 messages that worked before. So if your implementation is not idempotent, you will run into big issues because you will retry them a lot of times. Kinesis has this, on the consumer side, you have the option to, for example, reduce the the message size if you read from the stream, so that you can kind of try to figure out where the problem is in the stream. So reduce number of messages each time you retry to make sure that you get to the point where the problem arises. And then you can also add a functionality where you basically move a record out of, or you don't move it out of the stream, but you push it into another system like SQS as well, and then you continue and you basically skip the message in the stream. But it's still in the stream, but you skip it when processing it, and then you push it into an SQS queue, for example, for debugging purposes.
Is this feature only available when I use Lambda, the Lambda connectivity between Kinesis and Lambda, or is it an API feature of Kinesis that I can use with other workers as well?
So again, that's a good question, Andreas. So I must admit that today there are many questions that I cannot answer. I'm not 100% sure, but there's this. It should be possible to implement this on your own as well with the API. So there's no magic involved when Lambda consumes the messages. But I assume you have to do some something. But you could also use, like, there is the consumer library, the Kinesis consumer library available. So this is like a, on top of the API and SDKs, kind of a like more convenient way, and it manages resharding and all kinds of problems that arise. And I assume that this library can help you as well. But
it's probably not a feature of the Kinesis service. It's a feature of the Lambda integration, and you can build it your own or maybe use the SDK for that as well. Okay, yeah, makes sense.
Yeah, so at least that's my understanding of how things work, yeah.
Okay, cool. Yeah, that sounds interesting. So, yeah, so Kinesis is... So it has its limitations, but I think, we both used it in various projects, and it was always a very helpful building block for an architecture as well. With its, it has its guarantees and its pros. It comes with some limitations, of course, as well, and that's always something you have to decide on when building an architecture. Which building block fits best for your needs? Is order really an important thing, or can you live with SQS and so on? And I think the maybe compared to SQS FIFO, the Kinesis service has the advantage that it's easier to scale it, because you can just add a shard, but the clients that interact with the API or the management of the shards and everything just happens within the service from a sending messages and receiving messages point of view. If you want to do the same with SQS FIVO, you have to create another SQS queue, and then you have to make sure that workers know about the queue and everything. So with Kinesis, you get a single endpoint that consumers and producers can connect to. That's what I would say is the big difference here. What do you think?
I agree mostly. So it's like from the producer side, it's completely transparent how many shards exist. So you just send the message. But from the consumer side, so if you're not using, like, for example, the Lambda integration or the consumer library, so if you really interact with the API directly, then you have to know about the shards. And if shards are added, you have to act accordingly. And if shards are removed, you have to act accordingly as well. I don't know many people who use the API directly for consuming messages, because you either use the Lambda integration or you use the consumer library.
Yeah.
Everything else is, I think, it's very error prone, yeah.
Okay, cool. Okay, Michael, so what's the next service?
Yeah, so the next service is kind of similar from the idea how it works, and it's a managed Kafka service. So it's called Amazon Managed Streaming for Apache Kafka, or MSK for short.
Very cool naming.
Yeah, so it's a Kafka as a service, basically. You get a cluster and like RDS kind of thing, so they manage it for you. And Kafka itself, I would say, works in a similar way than Kinesis data streams. The only, I think, for at least from my point of view, the big difference is that there is the 7 days data retention limitation in Kinesis does not apply to Kafka if you don't configure it. So with Kafka, you could, in theory, keep messages forever. I mean, you have to provide the storage capacity to do this, but it's possible. The other benefits are, I mean, it's open source. So you could use it outside of AWS. You can run it locally, and for developers, that's might easier. And it also scales horizontally. So you can add what Kafka calls a broker, and you create a topic. That's kind of the stream in Kinesis. And a topic is a partition. So instead of shards, you have now partitions. But you still have the problem of adding partitions, removing partitions. So the whole management is definitely more complicated compared to Kinesis. Yeah, you get the benefit that you can persist data forever if you like and can afford it. So that's, I think, one of the only benefits. I mean, the biggest problems that I see is that there's no good integration into the AWS ecosystem. So, for example, a Kinesis stream, you can attach a Lambda function for processing, and that's not possible with managed streaming for Apache Kafka. So it only works if you have EC2 or containers that interact with the Kafka API, and you really have to understand how Kafka works. And I can tell, so I was working as a software developer before I started my the AWS stuff here, and it's not so easy to really get this right. So the Kafka interface is not super easy to understand, and you have to get the details right. Yeah, it's a complicated system, and if you understand it fully, then it's definitely a cool thing. But it's much more complicated to use than Kinesis data streams. So that's what I can say.
Yeah. So one thing, Michael, what's interesting, I think, is that Kinesis did not catch up with that feature that you can specify a retention period of longer than 7 days. So that's really interesting, because I don't think that should be too much of a problem from an AWS perspective. But yeah, interesting that they didn't, that they do not move. It seems they do not really move forward with Kinesis a lot. So it's there, it works, but I haven't seen major feature announcements for a long time now. Interesting. One other thing, Michael, I think from our experience, so we were involved in a project where we built up a Kafka cluster, the infrastructure as code for a Kafka cluster. And as with all distributed services, there is a lot to learn about a system that you can really operate a distributed system at a production level great. So I think what's really cool with Amazon MSK is that you get that as a managed service by AWS, and you don't have to do what AWS calls the heavy lifting for a Kafka cluster, because I remember that there was really a lot that you need to think about. So how do you do rolling updates of the cluster? How do you make sure the different partitions come up again after you replacing a node and all that stuff? So I think having that as a managed service really helps a lot. To focus on building a problem for you, a solution for your problem, instead of building a complex infrastructure on AWS.
Yeah, I agree. So one other kind of funny thing here is that Apache Kafka requires a Apache zookeeper for the kind of assigning partitions, for example, to topics and things like this. So all the management data is in a zookeeper. And is zookeepers also used to make sure that all the nodes have the same understanding of how the world looks like. And if you only require a zookeeper cluster, and then you could also use MSK. You can create an MSK cluster and basically only use the zookeeper nodes. So if you want to have a managed zookeeper, then you can also use the same service. But it might be a little bit expensive. I don't know. Depends on how much you want to spend.
Yeah.
But it's possible.
I remember zookeeper. Really, every time I have to set up Zookeeper for one of our clients, that's really one of the distributed systems I really have a lot of respect for, because it's so hard to get that right. I spent so many times debugging problems with Zookeeper. It started 10 years ago when we used it first, and it's still nowadays so many times I have crazy situations where the data that is coming back from Zookeeper is no more consistent than you start debugging that open source project. So if you can avoid managing Zookeeper on your own, that's really what I've learned a lot.
Yeah. Okay, so last point about MSK, the pricing. So you pay per node in the cluster, no matter if you use it or not. So that's kind of a baseline cost. And you also pay for the provisioned storage, no matter if you use it or not. Mm-hmm. So it's completely different pricing model than what we saw before, where we had lots of pricing based on messages. So with MSK, you pay per hour of the size of the cluster, and that's it. Use it or not, it doesn't matter. AWS will still charge you for the nodes. So let's go on with the next system, and this is called Amazon MQ, and this is, you could also call this Amazon managed queuing for Apache Active MQ, so then it would be consistent with the previous name. So it's basically a Active MQ as a service. So mm-hmm. Active MQ is a message broker, and it works like in a similar way than you deploy RDS databases. So you can have a kind of highly mode where two nodes are deployed in different zones, and then the data is replicated because they use, or I have to go into more details here, but like in the high available setup, they use an EFS file system underneath for persistence. And that's how they make sure that if the one node fails, the node in the other zone takes over and the data is in sync. So they share the data over EFS, which is a problem if you look at the message rate that you can send. Because that's pretty low. So you can expect to send 80 messages per second if you use the HA mode of Amazon MQ.
Is it for the whole system? Yes.
Yes.
Oh,
so it's okay. Only two nodes. That's the system.
Okay.
There's a active broker, and then there is the standby broker, and you can send 80 messages per second to the active broker. That's it.
Can I ask a question? So do you know that? Is it the failover from the active broker to the standby broker? How does that happen? Is it similar to RDS with a DNS name or?
Yeah, I can remember from using ActiveMQ, and this is not related to the MQ service, that in the connection string, you actually specified both brokers and then the client figured out which one is the active one.
That's correct. I remember that as well, because we used ActiveMQ many, many years ago. When working in a team where we built a microservice architecture, and their ActiveMQ was basically the broker for the messages between those services. I remember that as well. Yeah, it's correct. The clients were capable to do so. Yeah, but yeah. Okay, interesting. Cool. So yeah, what else is important about ActiveMQ, Michael?
Yeah, so I think the a few important aspects to add. So I mentioned that you can use the EFS as a storage backend, and this is, you don't really see this, it's managed by the MQ service, but it's backed by EFS, the Elastic File System. You can choose other storage layers like EBS, but then you don't have data replication, and you can also use like in-memory if you like. So if you cannot tolerate losing messages like once they are persisted, then the only option is EFS. And I think that's the biggest or the use case where you use ActiveMQ. If you really want to be sure that this message, once it is persisted and the transaction is committed, you will not lose the message. And that's the big benefit here, that this is a system like ActiveMQ can be part of a distributed transaction. So if you have a relational database that also supports this, and mostly all of the databases do, and then you can write something into your database, you can write something into the stream, and then you have a two-phase commit, and both of the systems will commit the message, and you will not end up with a system where the database entry is made, but the message is not sent into the queue. So that's pretty cool, and the limitation is that you can do this only 80 times per second.
Okay. So Michael, I didn't understand that 100%, so maybe one question about it. So does that mean I can, if I have microservices, I can basically have a transaction that spans multiple microservices, which also involves persisting data to a database. Is that correct?
Yeah, so I wouldn't say that you can have a transaction that spans multiple microservices, but if a microservice, or it doesn't matter, if a service, like in one go, you write something into a database and you want to send a message to a queue, then you can start a distributed transaction and you write into the database, and the database says, okay, I'm okay with committing this, then your queuing system says, okay, I'm okay with committing this, and then you send the final commit to, and both systems will commit the message. That's kind of the two-phase commit kind of approach.
So it's two involved parties here. So, mm-hmm.
And this also works like you can start from reading the message from the queue into the database, into another queue. So all kinds of possibilities are available. So other benefits of ActiveMQ, it supports a wide range of protocols. So if you are in the Java space, then JMS is more or less the way to consume messages from queues. But it also supports AMQP, MQTT, STOMP, OpenWire, and a few other protocols. So it's pretty flexible in terms of who can connect to it. And the last thing that I want to add, or not the last thing, but there are two more things. So pricing works the same as with the managed Kafka. So you pay per cluster and for the storage. But you only pay for the consumed storage here because it's EFS. The other thing is that if you need more than 80 messages per second, then you can create what ActiveMQ calls a network of brokers. And then things get more complicated. Like then you are, you care about partitions. Like as you care about partitions, you then care about your network of brokers. But it's possible to increase the limit of 80 messages per second if you have multiple brokers in a network of brokers.
Cool stuff. So is there any other messaging service on AWS, Michael, or is it those that we talked about?
Yes, I have one more. And this is kind of, I would call this like a niche service for messaging. And it's IoT Core. And IoT Core provides a scalable MQTT broker. So whenever you need an MQTT broker, then you can use IoT Core, no matter if you need IoT or not. There is no order guarantee of messages here, again. And MQTT has quality of service levels, like at most once and at least once and also exactly once, but IoT Core only supports at most and at least once, which means that you either receive the message once or more than once, or you receive it zero or one time. So that's kind of the two options you can choose from. The cool thing of IoT Core is that you can define rules, and then those rules are applied. So for example, you can say, if a message is sent to this topic or this topic prefix, then trigger Lambda function, or push this message into DynamoDB, or push it into an S3 bucket. So there are all kinds of options available here.
Yeah, so basically AWS IoT integrates with a lot of other AWS services. That's what you get here. Okay, so what's the pricing model for IoT Core?
You pay per message. Okay. That's pretty cool, yeah.
And from a scaling perspective, is there any limits how many messages I can send through that system?
So it's not disclosed. So I asked AWS support, and they are not telling you how many messages it supports. But yeah, so it's not documented and it's not disclosed what the upper limit is. But
very cool thing. So how should I use a service where I don't know how many messages I can send to it? So please, AWS, update the documentation. That's really annoying.
Yeah, so it's... I think for most use cases, it will work. And if you have like really big use cases, then you should... contact your AWS.
Need to check that before building everything. Okay, cool. So, Michael, I have seen that you have created a cool, very cool comparison table comparing all those services that you have been talking us through. I think this is really something you have to, it's really hard to talk about it in a podcast, but it's a really cool thing to have a look at. So we will add a link to the CloudCraft blog post, where we will find the table that really compares the different services in a lot of categories, basically. So I think this is very helpful when you create an architecture and you want to decide which messaging services fits our needs.
Yeah, so that's definitely something that I check out. So there are many dimensions where I compare the different services. And so, yeah, that's one way to figure out which one is the option that is best for your use case.
Is there anything that we need to talk about that we haven't yet? So is there any category or criteria that we haven't talked about yet, or is that already covered?
Yeah, so I think the things that we have not talked about is the like encryption features, for example, but basically you can say that all of them support encryption in transit and at rest. There's only one exception, but yeah. So you can expect like from like what you expect usually from AWS services that there's like high quality services with all the security features built in, including encryption, and that's true for all the messaging services. So that's fine, yeah. So yeah, I think we have talked about everything that is related to messaging on AWS, which is quite a lot of stuff.
Yeah, cool, Michael. So this was really a very good introduction and walkthrough all the available services. And as always, I like your insights into the services from a practical perspective, because it's one thing to read through the marketing documentation from AWS, and it's the other thing to really have been using those services in the real world. So yeah, thanks a lot for that and for talking us through the details here. So there is one thing I want to say before we end this episode. This is please subscribe to the Cloud On Out podcast wherever you listen to podcasts, for example, with Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, to make sure you always get our latest episode to your mobile device. And we would also ask you to please share this podcast with a friend. So recommend it to anyone who likes to learn about AWS services and technologies. And last but not least, please send us feedback. You will find links to Twitter, email address, and so on in the show notes. And also, if you leave a review in your favorite podcast player, that would be helpful as well. So thank you very much for listening. We will be back in 2 weeks. Bye.
Thanks. Bye.